Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And we're finally wrapping up season 10, the sloggiest season yet.
The one we really didn't.
It's rough. Well, it's just like, in addition to the general just ineptitude of most of the plotting and much of the episodes, beyond that, like, they have at least two episodes that, like, make us viscerally ill, you know? And, you know, they were both fairly recent, but that Richard Jewell episode and the Richard Jewell episode followed by Mr. Scratch are both, like, such fundamentally toxic and horrible episodes. That it makes it rough to watch through. Like, there's a lot of bad episodes coming up, but I don't know how many more
we can take.
Well, no, obviously we're going to watch them all.
We
I'm not
have
a monster.
To take
yeah, we do. We've made that commitment. No, what I'm saying is, and you can tell me what you think about this. I'm wondering, right, if there's like a lot more truly awful, ugh, makes you sick to your stomach with what this episode is doing, or from here on out, is it just, you know, oh, sloppy. Well, yeah. Yeah, it's just, you know, just general, we're bad at making television.
Well, this is it'll be interesting to see, because what I was thinking about just before you called, actually, and I was thinking, well, you know, SVU, like, because what they say, what you'll read too is, well, you know, the premise is getting tired and blah, 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 blah. I'm going, no, it's that these people can't do it, because SVU has managed
20 some years now.
Law and Order managed for years and years and years and years and years.
Yep.
No, there, and it's not like there aren't stories to tell.
No. And I think that's a really strong point, because there are still stories to tell. It's just, they're not good at it.
I mean, they just got this Isaac Keyes guy, you know?
Yeah.
Didn't even know he existed.
Israel Keyes.
Never mind. I just got the book out now, and I'm going to start.
It's fascinating. It's a fascinating story, and I look forward to hearing you tell us about it here on the show as you read the book.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a fascinating story where it's like he was just going around killing people for how long, and people had no idea.
Absolutely no idea. He had kill kits stashed in places.
Yep. And he treated it like it was his part-time job.
Yeah.
You know, he was serious about it. It's fascinating. So he would never have to travel. When he was going to kill someone, he would never have to travel with his killing tools.
Yeah.
Because he would have made a separate, wholly unrelated trip to go there and kill people. Like, to prep for killing people.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like...
It's fascinating. It really is. It's terrifying, but it's fascinating.
Yeah.
All right. But yeah. Like, because the thing is, the inspiration and the inspired are so awful, right? And I don't know. I mean, I've watched, again, season after season. I don't know if I ever saw another episode as just, ugh, and unpleasant as those two episodes of the show. And I don't know. Like, there's some stuff they do. There are episodes to come that will completely, you know, reset the meter for what the dumbest episode of Criminal Minds ever is, right? Like, that's still coming. Mm. You know, we haven't reached the nadir for Criminal Minds stupidity. But I will say this, like, I don't know if there's ever going to be a message as loathsome as we got out of the Richard Jewell or the Mr. Scratch episode. Even as Mr. Scratch keeps coming back, like, they forget what the point of his character was.
Duh!
Like, it just kind of goes away quickly enough.
You're going, and... Yeah, you are surprised because you're not.
No, I'm not. It's that's the show, right? But all right, let's get started with episode 22, Protection.
Yep. When three Los Angeles, California residents are gunned down, the BAU suspects the crimes were committed by a mission-oriented vigilante determined to punish anyone who commits a criminal offense. And the funny thing is, this is done by Virgil Williams, but it has the Bruce Zimmerman CSI ending.
Yo, does it ever. That being said, I did know immediately that they weren't real the first time I watched it.
Well, yes.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Like, you got a bunch of ladies telling him he's right to be murdering people? Yeah, they're obviously not
real. I don't think so.
That's not the kind of thing that happens. You know, but here's my question to you that I had when watching the episode. And maybe I just missed it in the background. Did he kill a postal worker?
Yes.
He did. Okay, he did kill a postal worker.
No, I didn't see that.
When they're running up, I didn't see a body.
Yes, 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 yes. There was the body. You missed it.
There was a body. Okay.
Good. You were doing it too fast. Yes. There was a body, and she says you just killed the postman.
I know, but no, not that. That scene I know. I'm saying later when the cops run up, there's no body lying in the front walk of his house. When the team runs up to the house.
I would just say that's a continuity error.
Let's pause this for 1 second. I'm actually going to go check the tape. Hold on.
Oh.
All right. Yes. No, I checked it. He does shoot a postal worker. Yeah. I'm not crazy. Yeah. No, I honestly blinked during the scene where they find the body. And the reason I was confused was because I must have just looked away from the screen from the 5 seconds he was on screen. Because when they all walk out of the house later, the body has been removed. And it's like, and I'm like, wait, was there ever a body there? Because I feel like they would not have removed the body that quickly. Because he's walked out of the house, like, you know, not that long after. Actually, you know what? I say that. The end of the episode doesn't really make sense. Because you'd think they would walk him out of the house almost immediately after he's confessed and turned over the gun. But by the time they walk him out of the house, they've already digged up the two bodies.
Yeah, okay, now
that's what created my confusion. Because there's obviously a 5-hour gap between them arresting him and him leaving the house.
Okay, now.
It is not shown.
Okay, here's something I noticed.
Please.
As I say, I've been watching the odd time, my CSIs.
Yeah.
Okay? So I just finished watching, because I now notice things on CSI.
That you never noticed before.
Right? Because it just makes sense to be doing it, right?
Absolutely.
And what happens, right, is that CSI, because things don't really happen fast.
Right.
And what happens is, though, that they have weird timing, little timing things that will tell you that, for example, 8 hours has passed.
Right.
Like I was just watching one. I mean, there are other, I could give you other examples, but one example is where the skydiver fell down.
Okay.
And of course he's filming it all on his camera.
Right.
And they just, all of a sudden somebody says, like it was, so there's when it happened and you see 8 minutes, right? Like he had been filming the thing all the way and then he crashes. And then you keep going on and on. But when the team arrives, it's like 8 hours later.
Okay, I understand.
Like, because the camera, nobody has recorded to turn the camera off. So you see this
little time code in the corner to let you know how much time has actually passed.
This
is what caused my confusion, right? And it's honestly, and I'm sorry about this confusion. I'm glad I asked. Because it was really puzzling to me. That I could think of no conceivable reason that after they arrested him for mass murder, they wouldn't immediately take him downtown. But of course, within the world of the show, for some reason, they didn't so that he could walk out and see the dug up bodies.
Yeah.
And that's why the body of that is why the body of, because it's not actually a cop, that is why the body of the postal worker already gone, because it's been 5 hours of them hanging out inside that apartment until they walked him out. And there's no reason for them to have spent that 5 hours, but just from a narrative standpoint, that's what they needed to have happened.
Yeah.
Okay, so yes, this is a perfect example of the phenomenon I talk about where they don't contribute to solving the case at all. Because they spend all of this time trying to solve the case, but then he shoots a man in the front yard of his house.
House, yeah.
Then he shoots a man 7 times in the front yard of his house, and barricades himself in his apartment. Like, the case is over, whether or not. Whether or not they had shown up.
Yeah. Whether or not they had found back at the office.
Yeah. Like, had they not come out to L.A., nothing would have happened differently. Because, like, you could say, well, in this kind of case, they needed to talk him out of killing himself, but, like...
Why?
Why? Like, he'll be just as happy dead as he will spending the rest of his life in prison.
Yeah, like, there is a weird thing about... We've talked about this before, about, you know, suicide on this thing.
Yeah.
I know you want to talk, but, I mean, some of these people, you know how just...
Yeah. Like, we know how awful...
I guess it's just a principle.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, it's weird that that's where they draw the line, because, you know, they kill a lot of people for people who have a problem with murderers dying.
Yeah, well, when they get a chance to take off their own personal revenge issues, then it's okay.
And it's a different story.
Somebody, yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, but I mean, I go back to...
This had nothing to do with any of it personally, so...
Look at the rape fantasy episode. That time, even though they had literally the guy who was most likely to be helpable by treatment, Reed talked him into killing himself.
Yeah.
Like, so they are very up in the air with what they want. I mean, Reed only talked him into killing himself because he was going through his own stuff at the time, but, you know, he still talked him into killing himself.
Yeah.
So they really have no consistency on this issue, I think it's fair to say. Wait, I know, consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds and good writers.
Inconsistency.
Inconsistency. Yeah, it's, you see it everywhere. No, but it's interesting because it's like, fundamentally, they don't contribute here.
Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah, I mean, once he killed the mailman.
Yeah. Once he killed the mailman, it's over.
That was it. They would have known.
They didn't save anyone. Like, normally they save someone, but those two women are just delusions.
Yeah.
So, also, like, he doesn't live on a super busy street, but how did he dig up a mass grave in his front yard and drag two corpses out there 10 days ago?
Was it his front yard?
It was his front yard. Because they walk out the front door. That's why I was so confused.
I'd have to go back and double check.
No, you don't have to double check. I literally, it was the backyard. I literally just
now
went to check. Remember when I humiliated myself 5 minutes ago by going to check? Yeah, yeah. I just watched that scene. And
you know what's funny?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that that's a location issue as opposed to anything else.
Yeah, the
else.
House didn't have a backyard is what the answer
and,
is.
And I'm going, yeah. And so I fill in the backyard.
Yes.
Because that's the only logical thing.
No, I agree with you.
For them. Bad me.
Oh, totally. I know, right? We do that a lot. We try to help out.
We try to help out. We try
as
to make
best we can.
A lot more sense than it
than
does.
It actually does. It's true. No, but it's like it's a frustrating episode in that way because it's one of those weird episodes where everything the killer accomplishes everything he sets out to do until like all people with this kind of, you know, mental disorder, he becomes so sick that he just starts lashing out randomly in public, right? And they don't contribute to stopping him at all.
No.
And by the way, there is something I mentioned in my review that I just wanted to bring up here that is one of the funniest thing ever because it's a mistake by the prop people again. So they talk to a pimp to try and find out, like, the guy who used to be the pimp of the dead sex worker, right? And so they talk to him, and they're like, they talk to the guy, and he looks, and it's like, did you know this guy who was killed by this murderer? And the guy's response is, no, and besides which, my girls don't work on that side of town. And then you look at the picture he's looked at, and it's literally a car parked against a gray fence. Like, how did you know what side of town that was? There's a car parked against a fence. Do you know what every fence in Los Angeles looks like?
Clearly.
Apparently.
And he's not even from Los Angeles.
Oh, God. But yeah, like, it's just one of those episodes where it's just fundamentally, it's just a sad story.
Yeah.
You know? like this guy, he had, you know, severe mental issues, and his mother helped keep him grounded. And then she got murdered by a scumbag, and he blamed the people that the scumbag was coming to look for his mother's death. You know, it's just really tragic and upsetting, you know? And it's made all the more frustrating because the team can do nothing. Like, they don't help. Like, they don't make the situation better. They don't save anyone's life. So it just ends up feeling like a miserable experience for everyone.
Yep.
You know? And that's why it's such an unpleasant episode to watch, because it's a sad subject, and like, you guys could have stayed home and it wouldn't have changed a thing. And honestly, Jennifer Love Hewitt is so pregnant at this point that I'm like, you should not be going on these jobs. Like, really. Like, this character, it's irresponsible of you to be getting on a plane and going to police stations and dealing with that. It's like, I mean, JJ's job, right, always kept her away from the action, generally, until she came back, right? Like, yeah, she would be in the action from time to time, but by and large, her job always kept her away from the action. I think that's fair to say. So the question becomes, right, like, think about how early into her pregnancy she went on maternity leave. You know? Like, she was not as big as Jennifer Love Hewitt is. And Jennifer Love Hewitt and her job was always just sitting in an office going through files and occasionally talking to the press. But Jennifer Love Hewitt, like, is going out and
in the field.
Going to police stations, going into the field, talking to suspects, or at least witnesses.
Getting thrown around rooms.
I know. Well,
I mean, we know it's her stunt double, but...
But still, yeah, it's like...
But the character is also pregnant in the show.
Exactly. You know, it's like the character is pregnant in the show, and she should not be doing this.
Well, I think this it's is as simple as that. Fault.
That's true. He should have just given her... Yeah,
and Hodge should just say, no matter what she says, no.
Yeah. I want to be on the field. I don't care.
No.
I'm your boss.
I'm your boss? No.
No. You can't be out in the field anymore.
Yeah.
And that's, it's frustrating, but she absolutely should not be at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, and that's, I think, why it's such a frustrating episode for me, is just that it's like, they don't contribute at all. You know? They don't help the situation. They don't make anything better. They're just wasting our time and theirs, right? Even coming out here. And it's frustrating to watch. I'll say it. I'll admit it. I'm frustrated to watch it.
Yeah,
but I mean, this one specifically, it's like whenever they don't have any effect on, like, cause you listen to all of their things. It's like at a certain point, they get enough witnesses who've seen his crimes to say, yeah, he's just delusional. Like, and so they just look for delusional people because they can do that. Famously, they have that list of everyone with schizophrenia in America that they can just consult.
Yeah.
but anyway, they do that and they find his mother. And then they get it to him. And so, like, I don't even have a huge problem. You know, sometimes I make little jokes about how easy it is for them to find these people. I don't even have a real problem with how they find him this week. The issue for me is that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, nothing
they
do.
He would have been caught.
Yeah. He was caught.
Because he killed the postman.
Yeah. He shot a man in, he shot a government employee in broad daylight in front of a house that he owns. You know? So, it's over.
Then like, they would have figured it out.
I think even the LAPD, I'm just being mean. Okay. I'm not going to do
well, that. Well, no, but that's basically the assumption of the show.
Yeah. Of like, why do that the LAPD needs to call these guys in to cover for them.
I don't know like, why.
Apparently you don't need to, because this guy's just going to kill someone in public. Yeah, and had they been able to save anybody, it gives it a very different tenor, but they don't. They just, you know, fail. All right, let's move, on that note, let's move on to the season ender, which is as bad as bad a conclusion to a season-long story as they've ever done.
Okay. When Meg and her best friend are abducted while preparing to meet, who they think is a teenage boy,
Oh, that's a mouthful.
Yeah, I know. The BAU hunts for a predator connected to an online human trafficking ring that caters to serial killers.
Okay, so ring is quite an overstatement. You know? It's three people, and only one of them actually does anything. Like, this is the most disappointing, like, roundup that we've ever had on the show.
Like, no, this is supposed to be like Legion.
Yes, exactly like Legion. That's, I mean,
well, that's what I mean, they're supposed to be.
Yeah, Legion. If you don't know what we're talking about, listen to our Gone shows, right?
Yeah.
But this is supposed to be, it's supposed to be a giant interconnected network of predators. That is exactly what they set up in that first episode, right?
Yep. Yep.
And that is not the payoff.
Yep.
The payoff is literally, it's just a guy, his slave lady, and their son.
Guess what?
Who the guy kills immediately so the end of the episode can happen.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. By the way, you know what my excuse for this bad episode is?
Okay.
They ran out of money. And because Janine Sherman Barois had done such a good job with Strange Fruit with no money, they gave her the job.
Okay.
Do this, right?
I can see that.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, yeah, Strange Fruit. Yeah. I mean, it was no budget and it was their best episode that year.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. So,
I would say so.
You know what? So, I've heard crazier ideas.
I know. I come up with these weird things all of a sudden. You know, just out of my clear, I'm just going, yeah, but everything seems to run around money.
Yeah. You
know, on this show. I mean, for sure.
I could absolutely see that as being the reason.
Yeah, they had no money left, and that's why they could only have sort of three people running a huge online trafficking ring.
I know, right? Like, guys, that's not what we were promised.
No.
It's not what we were promised at all.
We were promised
that they
could go take into the next season.
Oh god, yeah. What was it? What was the episode in season 6 called? Free Trade or whatever that episode was called, right? We were promised that. We were promised a payoff on that concept that there were these giant organization of murderers out there who were, kidnapping women and brutalizing them, and then selling their body parts to perverts.
Uh-huh.
And again, there is, like, it is impossible to imagine that guy who lived in the horse barn, right, going online and coming up with $50,000 to get them to kidnap someone. Like, you can't. And then you say, well, as we theorized in that episode, maybe that guy cut a deal with them because he was willing to dismember people and they could sell the parts to other people. And I'm like, but that's not, like, when we finally see the organization, that's not the kind of organization they are, because they're just not matchmaking these giant things anymore. They're literally just people who grab... They're
picking up pedophiles and selling them online. I mean, picking up children and selling them online.
Online to pedophiles, yes. Or serial killers or whatever. And then you get a couple of unbelievably dumb things in this episode. Like, well, there's a ton of dumb things in this episode.
Well, may I make a statement right
please
now?
Please go.
That they forgot to go back and look at episode 6.
What do you mean?
Well, no. And but when you say there's no payoff.
Right.
What episode was it that they promised us? Oh yes, episode 1, right?
Yeah, episode 1. It's the first episode of this.
Okay, so the very first episode, they forgot to go back and reread that to see what they were supposed to do in this episode.
It feels that way.
Like, well, it's either that or they had no money.
Well, yeah, they had. I mean, let's face it, that's probably the real answer.
Yeah.
Is they had just run out of money. Yeah. But what's so frustrating about it when you watch the episode is, like, you're watching this episode and they've got this, evil group of people and they're super evil, super monsters. Don't get me wrong, but they catch them in the most ludicrous way possible. They imagine that the way they catch these people is that in addition to giving you a woman to torture and kill, because that's what they're selling you, You also have a signed contract that you have to dispose of the body in a specific way. And it has to be a specific public way so that the body gets found.
Yeah.
To which I would say, what advantage does that give you as a murderer?
Particularly since it means you can't sell off the body
part. Well, yes, especially because it means... That's true. I didn't even think about that part.
Well, that's why I said they forgot to read
the earlier episode with that thing about selling off the body parts, which is such an integral part of the first episode here. So they give a guy to be raped and murdered. So they sell a woman to be raped and murdered by this creep show, right? Mm-hmm. Who conveniently lives, you know, in Maryland.
Of course.
What an amazing coincidence, right? But then they're like, after you've raped and murdered this woman, I want you to run into her with a car on the side of the road. Why? And it's like, I want you to, the guy who has hired, who has paid for a woman to be brought to him, to be raped and murdered. I want you then to publicly connect yourself to that woman's dead body with the police. That's what I want. Like, why would you want that? Like, what is accomplished for you, the killer, to bring the police into this? Like, it's and this is this weird situation where, like, remember the first time they tried to do this story in season 6 and what I often call, like, the dumbest episode of Criminal Minds before they, you know, reset that bar 100 other times, right? I said that, like, so you've got these people who travel the country kidnapping random college students and then torturing them and murdering them at parties for rich people, right?
Yeah.
And the FBI's plan to catch them is have a woman in a random city we pick randomly pretend to be a college student and hope that she is the random person in the entire country they decide to kidnap. And that works. The worst plan ever. This time, like, the only way they're, because they couldn't, they came up with a group of guys who were impossible to catch, and then they couldn't think of a clever way to catch them. So instead, they just have, like, the dumbest thing in the world happen. Here, they don't do the exact same thing again. They just have a group of people who are impossible to catch. And then what they do is, they have them operate in such a way that it makes them being caught inevitable. Like, it's so insane. It is baffling to me that they got away with doing this script for the episode. Like, nothing about this makes sense. And they got away with it. Like, they were able to put this on television and, you know, no one asks for the money that they paid them for this hour of television back. Like, everyone who worked on this should give the money back to CBS. You know, like, that is how bad Mark Gordon Enterprises should not have to pay for this hour of television. That's how terrible this is. Especially because we're asked to believe, because I'm like, wait a minute, coincidentally, because when they went after Meg earlier in the season, right? They went after Meg earlier in the season, that was part of the plot, right? And I was like, oh my god, coincidentally, it's the same group of creeps? And then we find out that no, it's not coincidental. These guys who are getting away with it, who have the perfect setup to keep serial killing and murdering and never get caught, decided to target the family of an FBI agent. Specifically so they would get caught?
Obviously they were in that phase now that they really did want to get caught and they didn't want to keep doing it anymore. God only knows. Don't ask.
I know. I mean, I guess I'm kind of stupid.
I mean, you ask me these questions sometimes, and I just sort of sit there and I go, don't ask me, because
why are you right?
Why
am
I asking
you?
Sense of this. Like, I mean,
you're not going to, yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to sit there and argue with you and say, well, gee willikers, Jiminy, you know? I mean, there are times when I will argue with you about something, but this ain't one of them.
No,
you know, it just doesn't make
any sense. Any
sense whatsoever that they would do this.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, Legion, I don't know how the hell they caught Legion because we never find out and gone. Like, what led them to them?
To that barn, place? Yeah.
Like, yeah, when
they were a much better. Opening? Yeah, no, I know.
But you know that they had been doing that for years. It had wrecked this guy's marriage and everything else.
Oh, right? Yeah, they had been chasing these people for years because it's a very well-organized thing.
Yeah, and so well-organized that Mel was able to start it up again from prison.
Yeah, and I mean, he didn't even have to start it up again, I think.
No,
I think the implication is that they never really went away. It's just they needed a leader to come in and reorganize them.
Yeah.
And that's such a fun, such a fun show.
Well, yeah, compared. And I'm just going, you know, there. Yeah. I mean, never mind.
No, I mean, you don't have to get into
it that deep. There are so many things you could have done with this show to keep it going.
Yeah. And it should have been. And the fact is, when we get to, and I mean, I'm not going to get into this a lot, but when we get into season 14 and you see the character that they think is worth building a multi-year plot around, and you're like, this is what you think you should build a multi-year plot around? This guy? It's crazy.
Oh, well.
Right? But it's like, this is the story you think, oh no, this is gonna be worth being the main plot line of the last season of Criminal Minds. No, of course not.
Now, remember, we didn't know it was going to be the last season at the time.
You're right. I guess they had to decide on that ending before they really knew that. You're right. I'm being too hard if I suggest that they definitely knew going in that it was going to be the last season. They probably didn't.
Well, they should have known that once Les Moonves was caught.
Gone, they wouldn't keep the show on forever.
They weren't going to last much longer.
Probably. Because, yeah. But it's just so frustrating watching this episode because you're like, the way they catch them, you can't, like, because there's no psychology to it. Like, the only psychology to it is them saying, hey, woman who has been raped and tortured by this man for 25 years, also he's a scumbag who doesn't care about the two of yours' son. So they're only able to catch him because he murders his own son, you know, like, for no reason, while they're in the middle of the hardest job they've ever done.
Yeah.
Like, this is literally the most dangerous job you've ever done together, and he picks this moment to murder his own son. What?
Yeah. And you know, yeah. And the funny thing was, right, is that when you look at this and you go back to the one where Chris saves her.
Yeah.
Okay. And you go back to that one, and what you see is a shadowy male figure is going to meet them.
Yes.
And I'm going,
I don't think that's him or the son.
No, like, well, it's not only that it's not him or his son, given the plot they come up with this time, like to get them, it doesn't make any sense why they would have done that.
I know.
The first place, the worst because part there is. Were two women, there was no way to, like, the two girls would have fought back or whatever.
Yeah, like, his plan was to, this big, sleazy, greasy guy was going to walk up to them in the middle of a food court? And get them back to his van? How? How was he going to do that?
That was when I looked at that, and then you see this particular plan. Well, why didn't they have this particular plan in the first place?
Well, or something similar. A real problem is, right, when you watch that, so you watch the early episode when they're first talking and send their picture to the fake guy, right? So that's the first one, right? And so we see, like, a guy at the keyboard with them. And they had clearly not cast who the bad guy was, because it's not either of the men we see in this episode. So I'm like, that makes it seem like there's other people involved in this organization.
It should have been a bigger organization. No money.
Exactly what I'm getting at, because we get to the end of the episode. You're like, no, it's just three people who like went off.
Who had a personal vendetta
against her. Like, no. This makes no sense.
This is what we
No part of it makes sense. But, and then, oh god, the fact that we're asked to believe that Jennifer Love Hewitt was the whole year, like, in the background, working on this case, and it never came up once. Come on, show. No.
Well, yeah, but remember the Frank.
I know.
Somehow or another, they expected you to believe, without ever discussing it, that Mandy had been working on this case anyway. No, he wasn't.
The thing
he would have found him if he had been.
Well, no, I don't know if he would have, because like it is just a guy in an RV. That's actually kind of hard to find. Or a guy in a pickup truck. It's not actually that easy to find. But in this case, the frustrating part is, and this is why it's so crazy, what bothered me was that they said, they have, like Aaron say in this episode, we agreed that the torso killer likely acted alone. And we closed the case. And I'm like, except, A, you know that he didn't drive down to Riverside and club that woman and drive her all the way back up to Bakersfield. Like, there's no way that this, like, completely socially maladjusted guy who, like, we don't even see him having a vehicle. I mean, I know he had a vehicle, but we never even see the vehicle he has. Drove all the way to Southern California, right? And kidnapped this woman and brought her back to Bakersfield all within this incredibly tight timeline. Like, there's just no way that happened. And given the guy that he's this creep who lives in a horse farm and has no resources, he's definitely not the guy who goes online and sold severed legs to the pervert.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way that this guy, and it's like, you spent the rest of the season not looking into the dark web, and then at the end of the episode, the end of the season, we're asked to, actually, yeah, in her spare time, she was doing that dark web searches into who was dealing legs. In her spare time. Come on. Like, just come on. And this isn't even the worst thing the show's going to do about the dark web. That waits until next year.
Yeah.
Where it gets truly dire. But yeah, like, a bad way to end the season. And it's one of those situations where it's like, I would love to find something nice to say about the end of this season, but I've got nothing.
No, this episode was just, you know, and the fact that, oh, well, here, okay, let's just get to the Meg.
Please.
The Meg, Kate relationship.
Yeah.
And this is just to further say, when you said, right, that, you know, she doesn't, like, that she doesn't really think of Meg as her daughter at all.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, there's a whole bunch of things there that are just so wrong about whoever, well, Virgil, no, Janine Sherman Burwa wrote this with Jim Clementi. And so what I'm saying, what I was thinking is first of all, you know, is this your, well, it's complicated, right? You know, that this is, well, no, like she corrects, you know, somehow or another, Kate, you know, makes it clear that Meg is not her firstborn, or is
That's the previous episode when she's talking to the sex worker who's got a kid in L.A. Is this your first? And he's like, yep. Well, I mean, I've got another. I've got a 13-year-old home. It's complicated. No, you friggin' raised that Meg since she was 2 months old.
Yeah, why isn't she saying that this is my second? Anyway,
it is your second.
And then in this episode, you know, I watched it, and I just, after our whole discussion last week
about this,
about all of this, I don't want to go into it again, but it's just, no, it just doesn't work. Like, and the very fact, actually, no, that Kate sits down and tells her all the horrors.
Yeah.
Like, this girl knows all of the horrors about these predators and these serial killers and everything else, and she's only 13. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know.
But you don't do that.
No.
You just don't do that, because she had to have been telling her, like, when she was 11 or 12.
Oh, obs. She didn't just start telling her a month ago about this stuff.
No.
Because she's just 13 now.
Yeah.
So, like, obviously she's been telling her about this stuff for a while, and just the idea that she has, like, a code to put in the phone to only use if your life is in danger.
If your life is in danger, my good Lord.
Wow. Oh my God. And I want to point out that, like,
so she's raising a child who is terrified to exist.
Yeah, no, just terrified to be alive in the world today.
Yeah.
Like, a hyper-vigilant child who never feels safe.
Yeah. And they never say, do.
If they you're a hyper-vigilant child who never feels safe, how is she so naive that she hasn't figured out that this guy she's never spoken to doesn't exist?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, as I said, talking about, if you talk about it in terms of things that never make sense, I mean, and what you see, like I'm sitting there going, okay, like this is, and instead of dealing with the fact that this is one of the horrors of the job, that Manhunter, at least season two, Manhunter season two, deals with very well. I don't know. I think season two, I don't think went over as well as season one,
which is crazy to me. It's a much better season.
It was a much better season, and it focuses on what this kind of work does to people in the real world.
Yeah.
And this one expects everything's to be la-di-da, and you can tell your 11-year-old about people who cut up people and who, I mean, I just was going, yeah, okay. And you wonder why your niece has a daughter with problem with you? Yeah. She's terrified to even exist.
Yep. Well, no, because, and they want to make it, the sad part about the episode is they want to make it heroic, get it? Because she's told Meg all about how monsters work. She can work in the psychology of this guy, except like.
Well, no, I know that. I know why they did it.
Yeah, that's their intention, but it doesn't even really play because, I mean, no, the guy was just going to kill her in a second anyway.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't delay him really at all. He just sets up his tools and he's going to start stabbing her. And then the cops arrive. And it's like her talking to him for 2 minutes doesn't affect that at all.
And besides, if you have read John Douglas at all, you know that generally speaking, there is probably nothing you can do. Once in a while, you luck out is basically.
Yeah.
You know,
always try talking to them, but
don't even
statistically speaking. No.
No, that's what he says. He said, because you don't know what's going to turn this man on.
Yep.
It may be that you think you're doing something good, but this is the thing that's going to enrage him.
You have no idea what arouses these people.
No.
It's as simple as that.
It's that simple. So to say, in some cases, if you fight, it will actually make a difference and you'll be able to get away. Sometimes if you fight, it's the very thing that just sets them off and gets them going. And hallelujah, he found a good one.
Exactly. And that's what's so frustrating about the situation is like, and no, you cannot profile, like, you would have to know exactly who the person was and everything about them to be able to talk them down.
Yeah, and she's 13 years old.
And not only is she 13 years old, they know nothing about this killer.
No.
They didn't know this killer existed, you know?
Well, that to me is the least of it. She's 13 years old.
No, she's not in a position. She just doesn't have this information. Like, there's no way she has the skill level to do this kind of thing.
And as John Douglas would say, nobody does.
No, nobody does. Not realistically.
Not really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at that famous thing from the Hillside Stranglers, right? So they pick up this woman and they're going to rape and strangle her. And they go through her wallet and there's a picture of her sitting on the knee of Joel Cairo. How am I blanking on his name?
Peter Lorre.
Peter Lorre.
You want the real name.
Joel Cairo. Peter Lorre. Thank you. Peter Lorre. They're like, is that you and Peter Lorre? And he's like, yes, Peter Lorre is my father. And they're like, oh, well, we can't kill Peter Lorre's daughter. And they let her go.
Yeah.
Like, that's a true story. That actually happened.
And it's,
and you can't predict that.
Like, how are you even going
to? Yeah, it is every bit as likely that the idea of killing a famous person's daughter would have aroused them further.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, you can't predict that. You have no idea that there would be, like, and that's the kind of insanity we're dealing with here. Yeah. There's no way to know.
Yep.
Right? And so the idea that she could have taught her daughter, well, again, niece, like,
excuse
the proper
me,
technique for dealing
to
with this situation.
As her daughter, it's her niece.
I know, God. Their relationship is so sick, and I feel so sorry for that fictional character.
Yes.
I know it's weird to react the way, but I feel so sorry for that fictional character.
Yeah. No, I mean, there are, well, yeah, there are, there are. That's why we watch and we see fiction. It's just like, I mean, that's
to have that kind of empathy. Yeah.
I mean, that's why you read fiction. Well, we'll get to that when we start discussing the Alienist.
Yes.
The difference between the book and the
TV show.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting because it's like you've got this episode where they do so much wrong. And it's like, and it's
the last. It sends all the wrong messages again.
It sends all the wrong messages. And on to top of all that, it's her farewell episode.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, that's it for her. And you get that little thing where Hotch is like, well, there'll always be a place for you here. And I'm like, oh, that's so nice of you to say. But no, she's not coming back.
But what's so funny too is the way they do it. It's again, you know, this myth of somehow or another. Oh, everything we know about her relationship with Meg would not lead you to think that she thought that the year after her sister's death was the best the happiest, year of her life.
I know.
Best year of her life. In fact, it was the worst year of her life because that is absolutely insane. Her sister was murdered in 9/11.
Yep.
9/11 drove everybody in the United States crazy.
Everybody went crazy in the entire country.
Yeah.
And you were raising a child when you definitely didn't want children.
Yeah.
No. Like, you may have, like, created this
illusion
version of it in your head, but it could not have been the best year of your life.
No. It's simply because your sister died in 9/11 alone. Yes.
Yeah.
So you're passing.
Your sister and your mother-in-law died in 9/11.
You'll pass it to the child.
Yeah.
Because every time you look at her, you're looking at your sister.
Yeah. You're remembering that your sister died, and it kept you from ever emotionally connecting to your should-be daughter the way you should have.
Yeah.
Like, every time you look at your daughter, like, I'm not saying she should have put her up for adoption, but every time she looked at Meg, she is filled with, you know, the agony of having lost her sister. And that became the basis of their relationship, right down to, and it even fits into your points in this episode of like creating a hyper vigilant child who's terrified of that the world is constantly going to kill her.
Yeah.
Like, you're absolutely right. Like that the 9/11 thing actually factors into your theory about how she has caused Meg to view the world.
Yep.
So yeah, it's a tragic character. Oh, and then by the way, at the end of the episode, they're like, oh, by the way, JJ is going to have another kid too.
Oh God. Yes. Heaven help us.
But I think the funny part is, it's like, she does this whole thing. I've got to take time off to spend with my new child, blah, 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 blah. Happiest year of my life, blah, 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 blah. I can't do this and be a mother anymore, blah, 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 blah. And then at the same time, you're like, oh, by the way, JJ is having another kid. And it doesn't enter anyone's head for a second that she won't be back at work the minute that kid's out of her.
Yeah.
Like, she is going to have that baby, take 5 minutes to say hi, drop the kid off with Junior, and go back to work.
And even this time, you've got even better breast pumping machines. Just pumps it, you know, pumps the milk.
And then, heads off.
Yep.
You know, and it's like, we know which of these two parents is taking the 9 months off of work to spend with that newborn child. And it sure as hell isn't JJ. And we know that because she doesn't. Yep. We know that she doesn't because she doesn't. She's back early next year. There's no time skip. Because think about it, like, mathematically speaking, and I mean, it gets skewed a little because the final episode of the season, you know, airs in June, but they shot it at the beginning of May, but it's set in June, right? So she's basically not showing at all, yet she's going to be back on the job by, like, November. Well, she's not showing at all in June, so she's max 3 months, right?
Yeah.
If my math is right, that means she just had the kid in November when she's back at work. I don't know if my math's terrible, but, you know, if you're 3 months maximum 4 months in June, that baby's due in October or November. And it's like, it creates, and whatever they intended to say about her as a mother, we end up with this meta narrative where, spoiler alert, she was back at work a week or two after having that kid at most.
It is so weird. And we shouldn't be so hard because there's nothing wrong with mothers working.
No, there isn't. Except
that this show wants to say that these women have absolutely no conflicts. They're, nope. And these men, and Hodge as well, because it's not just women. It's men and women. And that their children are just fine. I've already brought up the Alex Cross thing, haven't I already?
Yes, you have.
At this show? But it's like,
I think you mentioned it once, but bring it up.
Because people may not have, you know, have listened because they
to that started episode, different exactly.
times. Okay, yeah. So here's the, this is why I stopped watching
reading
the Alex Cross books.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, they're not overly well written.
They're perfectly acceptable thrillers.
I was shocked to find out he was black because there's no way, which is, I suppose, really good on What's-His-Face's part. There's no way you'd know that this man was black.
Well, no, when you read the books, you would have no idea the character was black, except you say it's great that he treats him that way, but the problem is, it's a book set in a world where, like, there are no issues whatsoever for being a black FBI agent.
That's right, okay.
Where it never comes up in his job at all.
Yeah, that isn't the point about this.
No.
What got me with Cross, right? Yeah. Now, first book I read, well, okay, I could accept it. You know, and there's this terrible situation and his wife dies and he's got these two babies and blah, blah, blah. However, what happens in the next book? Because, right, he's remarried. He's now got two children plus a third one on the way and everybody's just fine. The children are just fine. Well, by the end of the thing, that second wife has delivered the baby and has been killed.
Oh my God.
Whatever. And then we move on to the next book. And then I went, oh, so at the end of every book, they've introduced the next wife.
Oh, my God.
And these children are fine. They've gone through three mothers in, like, 3 or 4 years. They've got a new baby. The new baby's fine. And the next one is pregnant.
Oh, my God.
It's a bizarre world. And I went, I can't read these anymore. This is asinine. I picked up, like, did pick up the fourth one. I went, oh yeah, I was right. He's now married to the nanny or she was the doc pediatrician or she was
whatever
the mailman, male woman. I don't know whoever she was in his life, right? There's always a woman standing waiting to marry him.
To be the next woman to be murdered by a devious serial killer.
Yeah, right?
Like, at a certain point, like women should start noticing that maybe Alex Cross is the common point of why all these women keep dying.
Yeah. Why are you marrying this guy? Because you know you're only going to last a couple of years at the most.
Oh, my God.
Doesn't matter if they go into hiding. It doesn't matter whatever. Women can be as smart as they want.
No, the serial killers will always find them.
Like, the women are written reasonably well. It's just
the contrivances of the plot that get them all killed.
But nothing is wrong with the children.
No, they're fine.
The children are just bitchy. They adapt immediately. They fall in love with their new mother. And,
God.
Maybe after three books, these children have figured it out, too.
Yeah, it's like they...
Okay, we don't have...
And by the way, that is weirdly... there might be a comedy there in a guy who, like, about a woman who marries a single father who's got four kids from four different women because serial killers keep murdering his wives. And it's like how all of the kids are just, like, not emotionally connecting to her at all because they know there's a clock on this relationship for when the next serial killer shows up. By the way, I've just pitched our Hallmark movie.
Yeah.
Like, the struggles of being a stepmother when the kids are sure you're going to get murdered by a serial killer.
The Perils of Being a Stepmother When Married to Alex Cross. Yes, Idea by Sheila Redmond and Dan.
I think we got this one. Jot that one down for later.
That's funny.
It is.
I think I'm coming down with a cold, but.
Oh, okay. No, but it's very fundamentally, you watch this, the way they treat these parents, it's incredibly frustrating because it's not that women aren't allowed to go back to work, right? It's the fact that the show doesn't see any problem, right, with the kind of work that they're doing, right? They don't see any kind of problem with her teaching her, on the one side, her teaching her daughter that the world is full of nightmare serial killers, all of which who are desperate to murder her, right? Yeah, like making her live in that world.
As we know.
Yes.
I mean, there are serial killers in the world.
That's absolutely. No one's doubting that. But to say that the world is completely full of serial killers that are hunting you all the time. And the fact that the show is smart enough, and the hypocrisy and the double standards, that the show is smart enough to every now and then criticize Hotch for his relationship with Jack while not criticizing JJ, who, if anything, is there less than Hotch's.
Yeah.
If anything, she is there less than Hotch's, I would suggest. There is evidence to suggest that in the show, that she spends less time with her kids than Hotch does with his kids. And that's crazy. She is there every day till 11. And we know they come into work.
She
never goes home. They're there every day till 11. She never goes home, right? When is she seeing these kids?
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
Yeah, when is she seeing these kids? I would argue never. She is never seeing these kids. And yeah, so that is the season as a whole. So let's look back. What is our best? What is our worst episode? Like, what's worse, Mr. Scratch or Richard Jewell?
Well, just given topic issues, Mr. Scratch is worse for... Now here, you almost have to, this is one of those ones where you have to have categories.
Yeah.
I'm looking at all of these episodes, right?
Right.
And going, okay, so let's just start from the beginning.
Okay.
If X had actually gone anywhere.
Yeah.
It might have been not too bad.
No, that's true.
It was a reasonable, and then I'm looking at... Burn. That was not a good episode.
No.
1,000 Suns. That was just absurd.
Yeah.
Completely absurd. It was just like the what?
Mm-hmm.
And then we ended up with The Itch, which no. Okay, Boxed In. Like, I'm going through here. Stop me if you come to one that you want to give at least kudos for something.
I'm trying.
Boxed In. The Darth Vader costume was adorable.
It was.
And I
it was
really
a very nice it. Darth Vader costume.
And that's one of the few times we've seen, the LGBT community, I think, seen in a reasonable
in an
light.
Episode. Yeah, the completely positive way. There's almost no gay characters on Criminal Minds. Every now and then, the gay character will show up, but it is almost none. Like, you're
well,
right.
I would be hard-pressed. What? I guess nobody's gay in the FBI.
Apparently. And every now and then you get a victim who's a woman, and occasionally she'll have a wife instead of a husband, or a man and she'll have a husband instead of a wife. But that is as far as they take gay recognition in the entire show, except for the one gay character in that episode. So let's call that the best episode of the year. Because A, nobody died.
Nobody and dies. B,
nobody dies, and they have a positive representation of a gay character, and Hotch got his son a nice costume. So those three things are going to be the reason that we call that the best episode of the season.
Yeah, we've got three. Let's keep going if the shoe fits.
Nope.
Hashtag.
Nothing good to say about there.
Hashtag, no.
Oh, God, hashtag.
The boys of Sudworth Place. That actually could be one of the worst episodes of the season.
It is.
It is. Between it and Scratch, Mr. Scratch, between...
Yeah, for how badly it depicts what child molesters are like, where child molesters come from, yeah. Like, yeah, between yeah. it and Mr. Scratch...
Those two are really bad, and they were both written by women.
Oof.
I think. No.
Oh, they were.
No, Mr. Scratch was Breen Fraser, but
that's Breen Fraser. Yeah.
And, of course, Matthew Gray Gubler couldn't care less what his show is about.
No.
Particularly, he just takes whatever they give it. He likes
his visual, and that's what he wants to do.
It's the visuals, and the story. Yeah. After listening to that last, okay, Fate. As I said, I don't even know why it was called.
I just love that every time you say the name Fate, I'm like, but Fatal was last season. Because I can't keep them straight in my head.
Okay, I mean, the only good thing about this episode was, of course, the Rossi revelation at the end. Self-actual, he meets.
Yeah, actually, giving Rossi a moment of being like, yes,
self-reflective.
Him being willing to say, no, I probably wouldn't have been there for you.
Yeah.
If I'd known. And just the fact that they have him say, I'd like to say I would have, but let's be honest here. No, I probably wouldn't have been there for you.
No, that was a good moment in that episode.
It's a great moment. No, it is a great moment in that episode.
It almost saves the episode. It doesn't.
Oh, I will agree with that completely.
Okay, and then we have the Forever People.
just trash.
Just trash.
JJ murders a person and it never comes up again.
Yeah, rather than going to therapy to deal with her PTSD, which is worse than anybody else's PTSD.
Apparently, according to her, it's the most special and significant PTSD anyone has ever had
in the entire existence.
To the point where she is completely impervious to therapy, and she knows that to the extent that she won't even bother trying therapy. That's how bad it is.
That's right, and it's so bad that it gives her the perfect right to go kill people.
To go kill a guy. Yeah, no, she's completely entitled to do that, because that's how super special it's not even PTSD, it's that much worse. God, we really have turned on JJ this year. They don't even have a name for it. That's how much worse it is than PTSD. And all these people who talk about PTSD, they're just whiners compared to what she went through.
You want to slap whoever. Actually, I want to slap.
Not her. It's whoever. Yeah, it's not her. It's whoever wrote that line.
This, or whoever said write this.
Yeah. No.
And that was Breen Fraser again.
What the hell, Breen?
The showrunner said.
Yeah. I know. But I mean, sorry. That whole line, that whole scene, everything about it is so disgusting. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she murders a man and everybody gives her a pass because she's going through some stuff? Jesus.
Yeah. And then we have Anonymous.
Anonymous. Okay.
Okay.
An episode that would just existed.
It existed. It's, it's middle of the road for this season. And then Nelson Sparrow, which is third worst.
Only because
we didn't like it.
Yep.
It's dumb.
We just hate it. We just hate that episode.
Yeah, it was dumb.
Yeah.
And then we have Hero Worship.
The only episode that can compete with Mr. Scratch.
As a whole.
Yeah.
Right? As a whole.
For worst episode of the year.
In terms of messaging. And as I said, let's go watch Clint Eastwood.
We're going to watch and talk about the Clint Eastwood movie. We're going to sit down and watch that movie, and then we're going to do an episode about that movie and its treatment of the FBI.
Yeah.
That's going to be a bonus episode. Well, actually, the people listening to this, that was a bonus episode 8 months ago.
Yeah, because I think I just realized.
It opens up next week for us. So, yeah.
So.
All right. Hero Worship, then.
Scream.
The episode that, like, oh, right. That was an episode this year.
Do you know something?
What?
You know, I mean, it is really the way they treat child abuse.
Yeah.
This season is.
Has taken a weird turn.
Has taken a weird turn. This is almost taken. It's no wonder that if you hadn't been committed to writing those stupid blogs,
I know
I would have stopped. I mean, there's watching a whole bunch it. Of yeah. reasons why I would have stopped, but because this is why we stopped watching SVU. Yep. And as I said, I mean, it's come back.
It's gotten better since that. Everyone has said that.
Yeah. And SVU, I mean, took this bizarre turn.
It's SUV, on issues but yes. of
child abuse and predators yeah. and things like that. And I think it's, I don't know whether, like, I mean, now that I'm looking at this show, I'm going, you know, I mean, maybe they got a new showrunner because they had a bunch of people leave and they had, you know, like, it was just weird what happened. It was after, yeah.
Well, I'm anyway. Sure it was new showrunners coming in that righted the ship, so to speak.
Yeah, I think they might have just brought, yeah, and took it back to what it's supposed to be doing, which is dealing with issues and dealing sometimes with the gray areas of these issues. Yeah. Like it was never that clear. And then all of a sudden it just took this weird turn. And I just said, I can't watch anymore.
Yeah. And I stopped, no, I remember.
But,
this episode, if I wasn't committed to the exploration of this show as a whole, yeah. You're right. This is the kind of season that might have made us give up on the show entirely.
Yeah, yeah. It's just because of the way it deals with these issues. Anyway,
yeah.
So let's go on to Lockdown.
Just a dumb episode. An episode that's so dumb that I honestly, you know, don't really know what happened in the episode. Like, you get to the end of the episode, I'm like, I'm not sure what happened that episode.
Well, and nothing happened at the end, and there was no... And,
yeah.
and as I said, I still think that maybe somebody came in and maybe rewrote the episode that. Was supposed to be different and somebody came in and did the censor thing. Oh, I was just listening to standard practices, right?
Standards and practices. Yeah. That's what they call the network censors.
Everybody's got to go onto YouTube and watch Smothered.
Okay.
The hour and a half documentary about the Smothers Brothers and the show.
I did watch that. It's fantastic.
It is a fantastic show.
Yeah.
And I saw it. But when he's constantly talking about standard practices.
Standards and practices.
At CBS. It's
standards and practices.
Yeah. And, you know, and what the lawyers do at CBS. And it's funny because the guy that was the VP that had put the Smothers Brothers show on initially yeah. just because he had to fill in time because they were running against Bonanza, right?
Yeah, they just needed something. Yeah,
they needed something so
to put on the TV.
It didn't matter what they put on, right?
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a hit.
But a giant.
He was the one. They won their lawsuit against CBS.
Yeah.
And he was the one because he was called, right, by the defense, and he just said, yeah, the lawyers, when he didn't get one of his reels in on time,
yeah,
one of his shows in on time, and the lawyers just went, now we got him.
Yeah, now because we can cancel the show.
They were arguing, right?
Yeah.
They were just arguing that, no, this was unfair. They made it seem like somehow or another they'd been delinquent forever, and this was the only time it had ever happened.
And he went out and said, yes, they had been waiting for an opportunity to destroy the show. But we're going to let people watch that documentary for themselves. We're not going to recap it here. It's called Smothered. It's amazing. Like, I agree. It is an amazing documentary. I saw it on Netflix last year. It's on YouTube now. Go and watch it. It is completely worth watching.
Yeah.
All right. Keep going.
It will give you an insight to, I think,
how networks work.
Well, not just how networks work, but it will also give you an insight into that period of the late 60s in the U.S.
Yes.
You know, and
the social upheaval in Vietnam. Yes.
There was so much in that.
But let's move on to the next episode.
Oh, yeah. Do we have to?
We do.
Breath Play.
Just a terrible episode all around.
And then we get the, we attempt to deal with the mob again at Rock Creek Park.
Oh God. Just a mess all around.
And then we have Beyond Borders. Okay. Oh,
as bad as they get.
A Place at the Table.
The ripoff of Scavenger that, despite Tom Savage's best statement, best beliefs on the subject, I maintain is a ripoff of Scavenger.
And then Mr. Scratch.
Well, we've already talked enough about Mr. Scratch.
And then Protection in the Hunt.
All right. So, yeah, I think I'm ready to say that we're just going to arbitrarily say that Boxed In, or whatever it was called, is the best episode of the year.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, positive portrayal of a queer person, and nobody died. So, best episode of the year. That's a low bar. They crossed it. Okay, and yep. Worst episode of the year, it has to go with the ones with the worst messages, not the stupidest plots.
Yeah.
Right? And
there's a tie there.
It's kind of a tie. And here's what I'll say, right? That Mr. Scratch does more damage to the world as a whole.
Yeah.
Because it tries to whitewash, you know, and cover up for child molesters.
Yeah.
Right? And so it does more damage to the world as a whole. But I will say one thing, and I'm not going to say it's worse. I'm not going to say it's the worst episode. There is something uniquely despicable about using an hour of television to settle old scores and create an alternate reality where you were right about, where you did something terrible, right? And you've used an hour of television to create an alternate reality where actually I didn't do something terrible. I was completely justified in everything I did. And the guy whose life I destroyed, he was the real villain. And it's despicable. It's not worse for humanity, okay? It's not. I agree with that. But there is something despicable about what Jim Clemente did with the episode, with that episode of television.
Well, as I said, and I've just finished watching Matawan. I'll be watching it like three more times over the next little while. But I'm sitting there watching Matawan, and you know, it's like, yeah, really have to. And I don't. It's not even a political rant or anything. It's just I given the course I'm teaching next term and the rest of it, and I'm just going, oh, I don't think I can. Everything that's happening in the U.S. now is just a logical outcome of everything that has gone on before, because I've been looking at all of the real history as opposed to, and the attempts, you know, whenever for all, like, people don't like Young Guns and Young Guns 2. People want to write it off and the rest of it, but I'm telling you, at least they're trying.
Yep.
You know, and in the 60s, but they still, no matter, like, in the 70s, when they're trying to kind of redo something because they've gotten so discouraged with, I mean, everything that came out of the 60s is just a horrendous period, and trying to right the ship or whatever, and trying to look at things, and nobody ever succeeds, because what do we get out of the 70s? But Ronald Reagan, and then everything from then. But when you start to go back and you look at the West, and you look at, I mean, I've been, of course,
it's
looking
the same
at
stories,
but I'm looking at the Lincoln County Wars. I'm looking at Texas and the Alamo and going, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Texas wanted, was part of Mexico. Texas wanted out of Mexico because Mexico outlawed slavery. And
that's the heart of what Texas is, and that you've built up, Texas has built up a narrative where that's not, you know, it's about freedom and, you know, freedom and frontiersmanship and rugged individualism. No, they wanted to keep slaves.
Yeah.
And they created a myth to justify that after they lost the Civil War.
Well, yeah, well, the Alamo they already had. I mean, because Santa Ana made, of course, that classic mistake. It's always a classic mistake.
Yeah, of murdering everybody.
Of murdering everybody. Santa Ana should have not massacred everybody at the Alamo. And then the whole narrative would have been different.
Yeah.
Davy Crockett wouldn't have become this
martyr for this cause.
Well, he was a martyr for everything, and then they turned out. I mean, I have. Do you know if the TV show is on anywhere?
Which TV show?
Davy Crockett.
No, probably not. I can't imagine. I mean, it's a very old show, and it's almost impossible to find old television these days.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's, you know, and...
Oh, no, I mean, it's, but that's about creating a narrative, and we're gonna leave, I'll say that, we're gonna leave that here.
Yeah.
You are teaching a course on this, and if people want to find out, what the course materials, it's a very fascinating subject you're dealing with. And, it is relevant to what we're talking about in hero worship, because hero worship is an example of criminal minds trying to do the same myth making to whitewash historical injustices. But the tragedy is, and this is something that is kind of unusual for myth making, the historical justice was only 25 years ago, and the guy making the TV show whitewash it is actually one of the people who committed the historical injustice. Like, this would be like if Davy Crockett was the executive producer of the Davy Crockett TV show. Yeah. That's how bad this episode is. And yes,
it could be worse than Scratch, because you know why? Mr. Scratch at least has production value. It's worth looking at, right?
Well, no, but I'm saying Scratch does greater harm. Although it is, again, the same people whitewashing, the FBI whitewashing itself. But I think Scratch does greater harm, but hero worship is scummier.
Yeah. And
because it is a personal vendetta.
First, it took a libertarian to get Richard Jewell some justice.
I know. How crazy is that?
And then, of course, it takes Clint Eastwood to say, the hell with this, we're writing this movie.
Here's the real question. And this is what I want to find out about, and I want to see about the real guy who's playing Sam Rockwell's character. Mm-hmm. Because was he a libertarian or was he a civil libertarian?
apparently he was a libertarian is what the AV Club said. Now they only gave the movie a B+, but.
Okay, well, no, but we're going to save this till after we've seen the movie.
Yeah.
Right? We're not going to theorize.
No.
Cause here's the thing. Let's face it. There is a thing that we call civil libertarian. That's what the ACLU is, you know, that's what they're the forefront of. Basically, libertarian used to be one half of the term civil libertarian. And the idea was they were people who went out there and believed that individual rights shouldn't be trampled on by the government.
Well,
and
they were
that
classical
term,
liberals.
They were classical liberals. And that term has been co-opted.
Yeah.
By libertarians, Rand Paul, Ayn Rand, Ron Paul, like these just scumbags who are already rich and want to make sure they don't have to pay taxes, you know, like who want to be able to, I mean, basically the noble idea that you shouldn't make laws that make it illegal to be black in America has been co-opted by people who don't want to pay the taxes and think it shouldn't be illegal to drive drunk. So yes, it hasn't been a good era for libertarians.
No, for what we would call classical.
Classical liberalism.
I mean, when you go back and read the originals, you know, and then you get with this stuff and you just go.
Oh yeah, it's terrible.
It's okay, but this is what you wanted and this is what you've allowed. And,
that's a whole other conversation.
And then of course people have the right to be racists and destroy people's lives. So never mind. We've got to stop this. We do.
But I mean, naturally, it did come up more naturally than this stuff often does because it's we're talking about the government going to war with its people and losing and then settling the scores 25 years later on a TV show. Screw you, Jim Clemente. Okay. So,
all I can say is that we full well know that we have biases. And we are not apologizing for them.
Never once.
Never
All right,
once.
So we're gonna call it there. If you are joining us here next week, we understand if you need a break from the show. Fun fact, we're taking a month-long break from reviewing these after this episode. I mean, for you, it's just going to be 2 weeks before season 11 starts. But for us, we're taking, 6 weeks off because it's been a rough year of this show. It's been a rough 8 episodes, I think you might have noticed. But yeah, we are taking some time off. Not a lot of time, but a little. But so you can meet us back here next week for a bonus episode between seasons. We're going to be talking about The Alienist, the TV show on Netflix. So you can watch it there. And we're also going to be comparing it to the book, which Dr. Redman read, and I read years ago, but I'm not reading for this. So join us back here for that. And if you're not that interested in The Alienist, join us back here in 2 weeks when we're going to be starting season 11, which is the first Aisha Tyler season. It is the season where they try to do, they do a more coherent season-long arc than they're known for, and it still ends up being trash. Because
that's you.
Okay. Oh yeah, you're right. You're going to disagree with how they treat the dark web and the assassins as comma if, but interestingly, it is the episode. It is the season where they finally do Silence of the Lambs in their, you know, their various ripoffs. They've never done Silence of the Lambs. They did Manhunter back in season 5, right?
Yeah.
But they never did Silence of the Lambs until this year. So that's pretty darn interesting. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Although we're like 8 episodes away from that. I do think it's going to be a lot of fun. All right. So join us back here for that. And of course, after season 11, we're going to watch Beyond Borders. So that should be quite a ride. We'll see you back here for that. Until then, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you have any suggestions for profiling-related fiction you think we should check out, please feel free to drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We will see you back here next week for The Alienist. But until then, I'm going to say au revoir.
Have a good week.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.